and talked about his future plans all the time. He said he knew he probably wasn't good enough for the pros and that he was going to major in management. He had an uncle who owned a bunch of tire stores down south, and he wanted to do something like that, manage a franchise or something, and work with colleagues and customers. At 16, he was by far the most mature of all their friends, Brian knew. And yet, in spite of all that, he was here in Fort Apache, the Bronx, doing some sinister drug deal or something. It just didn't make sense. Chapter 51. What would Dad do? Brian wondered as he continued to stare at the car. That was easy. He'd probably walk on over across the street, tap on the tinted window, and demand to know what the hell was happening. But Dad was a cop, wasn't he? He had a gun and a badge and 20 years' experience in crazy, dangerous, drug-infested places like this. What did he have? Brian thought. A book bag and a friendly smile? Brian winced as he listened to the steel drum rattle of a passing six on the elevated track overhead. What the hell would happen next? He wondered as Marvin suddenly got out of the car with a small duffel bag. Brian immediately bolted out of the restaurant and crossed the street, tailing Marvin north under the L toward the intersection of St. Lawrence. As he got to the corner, he watched as Marvin made a beeline toward a tenement on the north side of the street. The run-down structure had an NYPD Safe Hallways sign above its main door that even Brian knew meant it was a hardcore drug building. Just then, three people, two jacked gangster-looking black guys and a tough-seeming, probably Hispanic chick with cornrows, came out of the building's front door and sat on its stoop. The girl lit a cigarette, and then one of the cold-eyed black guys snatched it out of her mouth as the other guy laughed. Brian ran up as Marvin was about to cross the street. "Marvin! Yo, Marvin!" he cried. "Brian?" Marvin said, staring at him in shock. "What the hell are you doing? Following me? You shouldn't be here, man. What are you doing? Didn't I tell you to leave me alone?" "What am I doing?" Brian cried. "What are you doing? You have to stop all this crazy stuff, Marvin. I saw you in that car with that crazy dude. Are you out of your frickin' mind? You're gonna get arrested or killed. Why are you throwing your life away?" Instead of answering, Marvin turned and watched over Brian's shoulder as a car passed by back on Westchester Avenue. It was a beat-up maroon Chevy. It slowed and stopped on the corner. The three street toughs on the tenement stoop immediately scattered as some chubby white guys climbed out of the car. "Oh, damn, it's cops! Come on!" Marvin said, tugging at Brian's jacket. Before he could stop and think about it, Brian was moving quickly with Marvin down St. Lawrence. They took a left on an even worse disaster of a street called Gleason and started running. They hooked another left on a street called Beach. Halfway down Beach, Brian watched as Marvin threw the duffel bag over a graffiti-covered wood fence into an abandoned lot. Then they ran all the way back to the elevated subway station on Westchester. "Come on, Marvin, let's just get the hell out of here," said Brian as they huffed and puffed on the stairs for the L. Brian looked over by Petey's Discount Liquors, but the Merc was gone. Marvin shook his head. "No, man, we just need to wait a few minutes. I have to go back." "Go back?" Brian said, disbelieving. "I have to go back for that bag," Marvin said. "Why? What the hell is in it anyway?" Marvin gave him a fierce look. "Don't you worry about that. Just wait here," Marvin said, pointing at him. "I'll be 10 minutes tops, okay? Just wait." Brian's phone went off again as he helplessly watched Marvin run back across the street the way they'd come. "Where the hell are you guys?" Dad wanted to know. "I'm not kidding, Brian. You should have been here an hour ago. Where the hell are you? Tell me now." Brian looked around as another train arrived above, its violent, industrial rattle like a death metal drum solo. "As if I know," he thought. "Sorry, Dad. We were stuck in a tunnel. Just got out. Train stuck again, though," Brian lied, typing quickly. but we should be on our way any minute. If we're both still alive, Brian thought, shaking his head again as he hit send. Part 3. Catch Me If You Can. Chapter 52. Paul Ernenwine and I were called to a surprise lunch meeting with Secret Service Special Agent in Charge Margaret Foley at the famous Bull and Bear Prime Steakhouse at the Waldorf Astoria. We found Agent Foley at a black leather banquette in the corner, sitting with a boyish, dark-haired 40-something gentleman in a tailored navy suit. "Guys, I'd like you to meet Mark Everard," she said. "Mark's with the DSS. DSS was the Diplomatic Security Service, I knew. The Security and Law Enforcement Service of the State Department. They were the guys who protected U.S. ambassadors and embassies all around the world. After you brought up the Russian angle at our last meeting, I asked around, and a friend got me in touch with Mark," Agent Foley said as we sat. "He's been with the DSS for the last 15 years at the American Embassy in Moscow. He also teaches a Russian foreign relations seminar at Johns Hopkins and is considered one of the most knowledgeable people about Russia in all of Washington. If anyone could broaden our understanding about the Russians and the way they think, it's Mark."
"Well, I don't know about all that," Everard said in a down-to-earth Chicago accent after a sip of his whiskey sour. "But maybe I can help. What kind of Ruski info are you guys looking for?"
"Well, I guess the first question is, how credible do you think it is that Putin or anybody else in the Russian government would actually try to kill President Buckland?" I said.
"Exactly," said Paul Ernenwine. "I mean, I know some of these Russian mobsters are nuts, but is it also true of officials in the Russian government? Of people that high up?"
Everard took another sip of his drink. "They're actually talking about the same people," he said, smoothing his tie. "Along with the oligarchs who seized control of the Russian industries after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the Russian mafia and the Russian government are all part of the same power structure." I shook my head as that sunk in.
"It's that bad? I mean, it's obvious Russia has some corruption issues, but that's nuts, isn't it?"
"Yep, it's nuts and tragically true," Everard said, looking at me calmly. "They all work together. The Russian mafia provides security and muscle for Russian industry bigwigs. Russian industry bigwigs pay off corrupt politicians and bureaucrats and cops. You actually have corrupt Moscow cops who have multi-million dollar properties in places like Switzerland and Dubai. Politically connected oligarchs have vacation mansions built on protected public land. They say Putin himself had a billion-dollar summer palace built for himself on the Black Sea with Russian tax money."
"How can that be? How can they get away with that?" I said.
"Easy. When asked about it, the spokespeople at the Kremlin all have the same standard Russian answer. We are not authorized to speak on this issue. Reporters who push harder have a funny way of ending up dying under mysterious circumstances. Everybody scratches everybody else's back. It's all one big rotten family.
With Putin as the daddy," Paul said.
"Yep, he's the top of the pyramid, the shot caller. He was KGB in the old days and ruthlessly worked his way up to prime minister and then president. Some say he put the squeeze on all the oligarchs during his first two presidential terms for a hefty slice of Russia's entire economy. All its oil, mining, logging, fleet fishing, telecommunications, everything. Because of this, the same people say that Putin is probably the richest guy in the entire world."
"Does that make him crazy enough to go after Buckland?" I said.
"Have you ever heard of the Russian apartment building bombings of 1999?
I shook my head.
"In 1999, apartment buildings in three Russian cities suddenly blew up, causing upwards of 300 deaths. Putin and the Russian government quickly blamed it on Chechen terrorists, despite the fact that massive amounts of highly sophisticated RDX Russian military explosives were used. Then Putin, who was prime minister, ramped up the Chechen war and then rode the war's popularity into the presidency."
"You're saying that it might have been a false flag?" I said.
"That he might have killed 300 of his own citizens to get his poll numbers up?"
Everard nodded.
And it's not just in Russia that he's not afraid to take off the gloves, he said. In 2006, Alexander Litvinenko, a Russian ex-FSB agent and Putin critic who emigrated, was actually poisoned and assassinated with radioactive material in London. Okay, that answers that, Paul said. Putin apparently has no qualms about anything.
Which brings me to the other reason why I wanted to have this meeting, Foley cut in. Putin is coming. Putin is coming here to New York to join the UN talks.
Putin is coming here? I said. But I thought Buckland was coming.
He is, Foley said. As if we need another ball to juggle, they're both coming. Putin and Buckland will be in town at the same time.
Chapter 53. With no traffic, it took the British assassin 2 hours flat to get to East Hampton, Long Island in the Camaro. It was the first time he had ever been there. He'd read that it was supposed to be a big deal, a Tony artist colony and summer playground for the rich, but driving down Montauk Highway, its main street, and passing a lousy Starbucks and a CVS pharmacy, he wasn't seeing it. Billionaires were attracted to this dump? What a grubby, horrid country America was, he thought, not for the first time. He couldn't wait until his job was finally done so he could get back to civilization. His final destination was east of Montauk Highway near Two Mile Hollow Beach. Behind the chain link, the address was more wood-shingled shack than house. There was a broken surfboard propped beside the front door and the rusting shell of an old Jaguar coupe under a listing carport. As he stood there, an old filthy dog that might have been a German shepherd came out from behind the ruined sports car and began barking. A moment later, a man in faded blue coveralls opened the hovel's front door. He took off a pair of oil-covered black rubber gloves as he came out into the yard.
"Down, airplane," Billy D said to the dog as he gave it a soft kick. "Manners now, girl. We have a visitor."
Billy D was a tall, lanky Australian with dirty blonde hair, dark brown eyes, and a net-like crisscross of fine lines up and down his long, weather-beaten face. He had a reputation as a highly competent and discreet mechanic and designer who'd work for anyone for the right price. He'd worked for the cartels, Wall Street hustlers, even Hollywood. The back of the house was one big studio-like workroom piled with tools and spare parts. The British assassin couldn't make out what half the stuff was. There was a drill press beside a 3D printer, an engine crankshaft on a blue rag-covered workbench, wired circuits on an elaborate breadboard hanging from the far wall.
"It's a big job, is it?"
the Aussie wanted to know.
"I only asked because you came with the highest of recommendations."
"Where is it?" the British assassin said, ignoring him.
"Straight to business, eh? No problem, friend, I got your baby right over here,"
Billy D said, as he brought over a milk crate from a corner and placed it down beside the crankshaft. Inside the plastic crate was what looked like a mix between a metal skeleton of a robot and a bagpipe. It was a jumble of hydraulic cylinders and pistons and clamps and wires, all jutting from the torso of a large electric motor box.
"How does it work?" the British assassin said.
"Okay," Billy D said excitedly as he lifted one of the pistons. "The signal opens the float switch in the control box here, which engages the magnetic contact over here, and..."
"I don't give a fuck how it works technically, monkey wrench," the assassin said coldly.
"I meant, how do I work it?"
The Aussie looked hurt.
"Install the hardware, then hit the app I already emailed you. Everything pops up on your phone screen, the video feed, the whole shebang. And Bob's your uncle, you're in control."
"What's the range?" Even more lines appeared on Billy D's old man in the sea face when he smiled. His crooked yellow teeth were sickening.
"What's the range of a wireless cell phone signal? Infinite?"
the Australian said and began laughing.
"That's the real beauty, yeah? You could be anywhere, mate. You could work it from the other side of the world." The British assassin smiled himself as he looked at the contraption, picturing it. It just might work, after all. He took out the large manila envelope with the 100,000 in it and placed it next to the crankshaft.
"I'll see myself out," the British assassin said as he lifted the crate.
"Pleasure doing business with you,"
said the Australian, already thumbing hundreds. A moment later, the big Aussie made less noise than expected as he dropped to the workshop floor with the back of his head blown open. The British assassin stepped over Billy D, straddling his waist, as he put two more in the big-mouthed grease monkey, this time in his temple, with his suppressed .22. There was no way he could have let him live. Not at this point. The risk was too great. The man had actually been right. This was a big job. The biggest, probably, of all time.
Too big to fail, he thought with a smile. Pleasure's all mine, mate,
the British assassin finally said as he aimed his gun to take care of the dog. Chapter 54. There were over 100 people in the West Chelsea gallery that night for the opening. You could tell right away that these were not the PBS tote bag schlepping bridge and tunnelers you sometimes saw at MoMA and the Met. Quite the contrary. With the amount of Botox and Hermes Birkin bags and bespoke tailoring on display, it was obvious that some of the most serious players in the multi-billion-dollar downtown New York City art world were on the scene. In front of the mixed media installations and huge paintings, you could hear exotic languages being spoken. Portuguese, Chinese, Russian. The art market, like the real estate market in New York, was red hot right now, with the new influx of foreign billionaire money. One had to have something just so to hang on the wall of one's new $20 million Skyview apartment, after all. Since I wasn't a foreign oligarch and my art collection consisted mostly of finger paintings on my fridge, I was there because I was on the job, of course. In the Chanel-scented crowded gallery behind me, about 20 feet away, over my right shoulder, stood Matthew and Sophie LaRue, the ex-CIA art dealers who, for some unknown reason, seemed to want to pull a Lee Harvey Oswald on President Buckland. They were under 24/7 surveillance now, and we'd been on them from the second they left their Soho townhouse an hour before. In his sleek black suit and expensively simple white shirt, Mr. LaRue certainly looked the part of the rich art dealer and could act it as well, given the expert way he and his pretty and slim wife, Sophie, air-kissed and backslapped with all the globally loaded folks in attendance. As I watched them, I couldn't help sensing how tight they seemed. The way they held hands and conferred with each other between meet-and-greets when no one was looking. They were attractive and sociable, but their relationship seemed quite real. They seemed like serious, committed people. Which was more than a little troubling, I thought, considering the two highly trained ex-spies seemed very much to be plotting to blow the President of the United States' head off in less than a week's time. I turned as my old buddy, Brooklyn Kale, arrived in a cocktail dress and handed me a club soda. I noticed that my head wasn't the only one turning at the sight of my tall and lovely partner in her little black undercover dress. I'd actually pulled some strings and had several of my old Harlem crew buddies reassigned to the anti-assassination task force. In addition to Brooklyn, I had Arturo Lopez and Jimmy Doyle in an unmarked Chevy parked outside across West 24th. With the president and now Putin due in town, and still having really no clue what was up, we definitely needed all the help we could get.
"What are these paintings supposed to be about again?"
Brooklyn said, staring up at the immense dark-toned abstract canvas in front of us. With their never-obvious inert compressions, I read off a pamphlet some pretty blonde waif had handed me at the door. Sheer Maget's latest work possesses a fragmented rawness that is at once a departure from, but also a profound echo of, his earlier works, often gummy, tactile resonances.
"Oh, I'm feeling those compressions," Brooklyn said, shaking her head. "Every time I look up at it, I want to pop a couple of Tylenol."
When I glanced over my shoulder, I saw that LaRue and his wife were suddenly moving through the crush of people.
Maybe they're heading for the bar? Brooklyn said hopefully, but they weren't. We stood there watching as Matthew and Sophie reached the gallery steps near the entrance and went up them and straight out the front door. Chapter 55.
Arturo, Doyle, look lively, they're coming out!
I called into my hastily dialed phone as we made a not-so-subtle beeline after the couple through the dense crowd. When we finally climbed the steps and hit the street, I could see a gaggle of models ooing and eyeing at one of those Mercedes six-wheeler super SUVs that had pulled up on the cobblestones out in front. What I wasn't seeing was the LaRue's.
"Where are they?" I asked Arturo. "Down the block on your left," he told me. "Damn it."
Half a block away, on the corner of 11th Avenue, I could see the LaRue's already getting into a taxi. No, wait, it was only one of them. Sophie LaRue sat in the cab while Matthew closed its door and quickly jogged east across dark 11th Avenue.
"What the? Splitting up?" Brooklyn said.
Had they made us? I wondered.
"Arturo, you guys stay on the wife in the taxi," I said into my phone as I hurried east with Brooklyn. "We'll stay with the husband on foot."
On the other side of 11th Avenue, Brooklyn and I picked up the pace as we watched LaRue moving quickly along West 24th Street's shadows and steel shutters. He was on his phone now, I saw. He definitely seemed purposeful, which was weird since the entire industrial area was completely deserted. Where was he going now, I wondered as I rushed to keep up, to meet his contact? He was about halfway to 10th Avenue when it happened. LaRue put his phone back into his pocket, then he hooked a sudden left off the sidewalk and dropped completely out of sight.
No! Had he ducked into a building? An alleyway? I wondered in a panic as I started running. What now? What the hell was up with this guy? He had just suddenly disappeared.
Brooklyn and I groaned in unison when we got to the spot where LaRue had left the block. Because it wasn't a building, it was a parking lot. An empty one that ran the whole block north to 25th Street. LaRue was gone. I threw up my hands as I stared at the lonely expanse of asphalt. He must have booked the second he was out of our sight. We'd lost him.
"You gotta be kidding me with this James Bond routine," Brooklyn said.
We'd broken into a jog and were halfway across the lot toward 25th. When the headlights of a vehicle suddenly swung off 25th Street into the driveway of the lot. It was a truck, a dark new Chevy Suburban SUV with black tinted windows. It was moving fast, too fast. I reached back and palmed the undercover Glock at the small of my back as the truck roared straight at us. I could feel my heart pounding hard in my chest as the vehicle came to a quick, tire-barking stop a foot in front of us. Then I was moving around the side of the truck with my Glock pulled.
"NYPD, hands where I can see them," I yelled as the front passenger window began to zip down.
As the dark glass fell, I held my breath with my finger on the trigger, thinking that in a split second, I would see the face of ex-SEAL turned assassin Matthew LaRue and a lot of lead would start flying. But I was wrong. It wasn't LaRue. Instead, a dark-haired boyish man was sitting there. He was wearing a nice pinstripe suit with a two-toned banker's collar, minus the power tie, like a Wall Streeter out for fun after work. There was a stupid smile on his face.
"Hey, Mike, how's it going?" he said.
I didn't recognize him. Then I did. It was Mark Evrard, the State Department's expert and advisor on Russia from the restaurant meeting with Secret Service SAC, Margaret Foley.
"What the?"
"It's fine, Mike," he said. "You can put away the gun. Honestly, we're all friends here. I could explain everything."
Still in shock, I looked in at the driver beside him, a mean-looking, stocky, middle-aged guy with thick forearms and hands.
"Mike, who the hell are these jerks?"
Brooklyn said, still training her own Glock at the truck.
"I don't know," I said. "Who are you jerks?"
"Mike, we didn't mean to spook you like that. I think it's time we should talk," Evrard said.
"High time, in fact."
"About what?"
I said as I finally holstered my gun.
Instead of answering, Evrard climbed out of the truck and opened the back door. That's when the real shocker of the night happened. Actually, there were two of them. My red-headed buddy, Paul Ernenwine, was sitting in the back of the truck. And beside him, sitting there calm as a picnic in the park, was none other than Matthew LaRue. "You got me, officer. I give up. Don't shoot," the blonde ex-Navy SEAL said, smiling as he held up his empty hands.
Chapter 56.
"Hey, my apologies again, Mike," Mark Evrard said. "I know we caught you off guard." We were heading downtown now through the meatpacking district, the tires of the Suburban changing pitch as we crossed at the cobbled intersections. Doyle and Arturo had picked up Brooklyn, and it was just Paul and me riding along with LaRue and Evrard and the driver. I didn't know what was going to happen next, but I was dying to find out. "Like I was saying to Paul, it seems like we've gotten our lines crossed here, Mike," Evrard said smoothly, turning from his front passenger seat. I stared at him. There was something smug about him that I couldn't put my finger on that really drove me nuts. The strong cologne he wore reminded me of the Big Bucks crowd back at the gallery. "Well, that's why I wanted to finally meet up," the slick bastard said, nodding at me, "to bring some clarity. Lay out what we're doing before we trip each other up. First of all, know that everything I'm going to reveal is top secret, okay? It stays in this truck." "Is this guy for real, Paul?" I said to Ernenwine, sitting beside me. "I was at dinner when my boss called and told me to meet up with him," Ernenwine said with a shrug. "He checks out, Mike, believe it or not." "Top secret?" I said, still mighty pissed at Evrard or whoever the hell he was in his stupid spy versus spy head games. "So I guess this means you're not in State Department Protective Security, huh? Let me take a wild guess. You're CIA. "Technically, I'm a retired CIA officer turned rehired contractor currently working out of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center," Evrard said, smoothing his lapel. "But it's all semantics these days, Mike. For example, last year I worked for the Office of the Director of National Intelligence in conjunction with the Department of Defense's National Reconnaissance Office, doing the exact same stuff. It doesn't matter whose budget my paycheck comes out of. We're all the good guys here. We're all on the same team." "And you?" I said over at LaRue on the other side of Paul. "You CIA too? I mean, when you're not selling Picassos or murdering Hamilton Heights drug dealers." LaRue winked at me with a cold blue eye. There was an unsettling, palpable stillness to him as he sat there, the tension of something fast, unnaturally at rest. "What can I say, Mike?" he said with a slight Western cowboy twang in his voice. "Murderers like me, we gotta stay busy." "Enough, Matt," Evrard said as he took a folder out from somewhere up front and handed it to me. "You're mistaken, detective," he continued. "That wasn't murder up in Hamilton Heights. Rafael Arruda's termination was an action authorized at the highest level." Inside the folder was a document printed on thick stationery with an embossed presidential insignia at the top. There was some legalese gobbledygook after the heading, but at the bottom I read, "Mr. Rafael Arruda poses a current and ongoing threat to the United States and therefore meets the legal criteria for lethal action pursuant to the presidential finding." It ended with the previous president's signature in bright blue ink. "The president is whacking out ecstasy dealers without a trial now? On American soil, no less?" I said as Evrard took the folder back. "Does CNN know about this?" "Ecstasy wasn't the only thing Arruda had his hands in," Matthew LaRue said calmly as he looked out the window. "For the last few months after a hard day's teach at Columbia, that slime spent his nights online lending his chemical expertise to an offshoot of ISIS in their quest to develop sarin gas. The members of his drug crew were actually trained by Islamic militants overseas." "Bullshit," I said. "Just bullshit. Arruda was a jihadist?" "No," said Evrard. "Just a worthless scumbag who didn't give a shit who paid him a lot of money for his weapons of mass destruction recipes.
Okay, fine, I said as we rolled. Let's say I believe you. You're CIA, and Aruda was an enemy combatant in the global war on Terra. How does that explain you guys surveilling the president's UN route in Midtown? Is the press staying up late Skyping with the bad guys as well? Does he too now somehow meet the legal criteria for lethal action pursuant to the presidential finding? Is it time to pull his plug too? LaRue laughed at that, hard. That really tickled his cowboy funny bone, apparently. No, Everard said. Matthew is doing what's known as counter-sniping surveillance. If the shooter is after the president, we need to see where he was set up in order to find him. Exactly, LaRue said. I'm not out to snuff Buckland. My wife and I were actually doing what you're doing, looking for the guy who actually is. We know him, or, at least, of him. What? I said, completely stunned. What the hell are you talking about? You know the shooter? We think so, Mike. We think it's this man, Everard said as he reached out and gave me another folder. Chapter 57. I flipped open the folder and looked at the photograph inside. It wasn't a very good one. A blurry black-and-white blow-up still of a dark-haired white guy on a sidewalk, taken from a not-very-good surveillance video. It could have been anyone, I thought. It could have been a picture of me. So you think this is the shooter I saw at the MetLife building? I said. Everard nodded. We don't know his name, he said. We just call him the Brit because about all we know about him is a snatch of his Northern England accent in a brief phone conversation we recorded in 09. We assume he's ex-British Special Air Service, but who knows? Their Royal Marines are pretty damn good killers as well. We also know that he's one of the most sought-after work-for-hire assassins in the world. The troubling thing is, like Aruda, he doesn't care in the slightest who he works for as long as the price is right. He's killed for the Japanese Yakuza, the North Koreans, the Taliban, ISIS. And he's not just any old gun for hire either, said LaRue. He's an amazing shot. He took down three of our guys from a high ridge outside of a fire base in Camp Dash in 07. I arranged it myself after we came in to get the bodies. He scored three kills at 2,500 yards. That's 1.4 miles. One kill you could chalk up to luck, but three headshot hits at that distance when you account for the wind and the Coriolis effect is just insanity. Gandalf the Wizard stuff. You wouldn't think it was possible. Who hired the wizard? Was it the Russians, do you know? Is Putin actually behind this? We're as in the dark about that as you are, said Everard. It's either Putin or somebody who hates Putin and wants to make it look like Putin, perhaps one of the Russian oligarchs. It's definitely somebody out of Russia. That's where the tip came from, right, Paul? You guys got a guy at the embassy, right? Why haven't you guys let us local law enforcement know about your information on the Brit until now? Paul Ernenwine said. It wouldn't have helped, Everard said. He uses disguises and aliases. This guy is an apex predator. You're not going to catch him with an APB. So what? I yelled. He's out to kill the frickin' president. To heck with the FBI and NYPD. This photo should be on the news. Also, how do you know it's this Brit guy? Paul wanted to know. We have access to more databases than you, Everard said. Our analyst plugged in the numbers. 80%, it's him. There are very few people in the world with that expertise. It's a process of elimination. I watched Everard and LaRue exchange a quick look. No, wait, I get it, I said. You're not out to protect the president. You're just hunting this guy. He's on your hit list as well, isn't he? Like Aruda. You didn't tell us because you don't want him arrested, do you? Like Aruda, you want him dead. Well, now that you mention it, Everard said after a beat, he is on the presidential finding list as well. Didn't you hear what I just said? LaRue said over to me. He killed three of our guys. Three Navy SEALs in Afghanistan. Not only that, but he trained a bunch of those savages to kill who knows how many more Americans. He's a real scumbag, Mike. He needs to be removed from the battlefield yesterday. Battlefield? I said with a laugh of my own.
I noticed that it had started to snow again as I tapped at the window. "That's not a battlefield out there, Matt," I said. "That's just West Broadway."
"Mike, grow up, huh?" LaRue replied. "Wise up. The war is everywhere now. The enemy, too. There are no more neat little definitions and borders."
"I get it," Paul finally piped up, staring at Everard. "You're bringing us into it now because we're investigating Maddie over here. We're getting too close to blowing your little hunting party."
"Guys, come on," Everard said. "What difference does it make if our interests are the same or just run parallel? We're on the same team. We thought we could take care of the Brit by now, but he's been more elusive than we had hoped. We need your help. Or should I say, we need to team up officially to nail him."
"Dead or alive, huh?" I said.
"Only without the poster? Or the chance of a reward? Maybe we can string him up from a traffic light in Times Square. Any word on stringing people up in the presidential finding?"
"Hell, detective," said LaRue with another laugh and a wink. "We don't need him dead, necessarily. We're so desperate. Even a couple of bloodthirsty murderers like us might let you bring him in alive. Just this once."
Chapter 58. It was 5 minutes to one in the afternoon on Tuesday when the British assassin double-parked the Home Depot rental truck in front of an ugly white brick high-rise on 2nd Avenue near the southwest corner of E67th. He could hear kids hollering and carrying on in the yard of the public school across the street as he slid the heavy rectilinear box out over the tailgate and slipped it onto a hand truck.
"Doing a little painting, are we, sir?"
one of the high-rise's maintenance men asked in the basement as the British assassin rolled past with the box toward the freight elevator.
"Work, work, work," the Brit said with a smile.
He took the elevator to 19 and rolled the box to the end of the hallway and took out his key. He had rented the two-bedroom on a popular apartment share website a month before when he was in the planning stage. As he rolled the box inside, he chuckled to himself as he remembered the website's New Age mission statement, "Trust. It's what makes the world go round." After he cut open the box, it took 20 minutes to assemble the steel painting scaffold in the apartment's living room. It had caster wheels for easy moving, and its plywood deck could be adjusted up to 6 feet. He moved the couch into the corner and then rolled the high portable platform into position across from the west-facing window. After he locked the scaffold's wheels in place, he went into the bedroom. A moment later, he returned with the comforter and laid it out on the plywood platform and climbed up and lay prone. He smiled as he faced the curtain window with an imaginary rifle in front of him. The apartment was warm, clean, comfortable. In other words, about as far from his usual blind setups as you could possibly get. As he lay there, he recalled a particularly nasty blind he'd been in Syria 6 months prior, in a downtown section of a small city he'd already forgotten the name of. He had lain in the deep interior recesses of a shattered shopping mall. For 3 days, in the stench of an open sewer, from a hole in the structure's wall, he watched the sepia desert light on the mall's ruined plaza as the government forces drove their dirt-caked, chirping, clanking Russian T-80 tanks around, playing cat and mouse with the jihadi rebels who had hired him. On the third morning, as one of the tank's 125mm rounds punched yet another hole in the already chewed-up building's northern end, he finally laid eyes on his target with his hunting scope. The Russian tank advisor's name was Alexandrov, and through the blackened, jagged stumps of some palm trees beyond the plaza, he could see him sitting in a white Ford pickup truck, coordinating maneuvers from just under 2,000 yards away. Even through the 10x unertal scope of the KSVK Russian anti-materiel rifle, his target was not very big. No matter. He calculated calmly, made his clicks on the scope for distance and wind. Then he resighted the reticle and calmly let loose with the massive 12.7mm round. He would have missed by a hair if Alexandrov hadn't leaned forward at the exact right moment. Had he been about to open the truck's glove compartment? The British assassin wondered, not for the first time.
Was he moving to answer his phone on the dash? To tie his shoe? The British assassin tisked. He would never know, and for a man of precision such as himself, to never know, stung. Oh well, enough strolling down memory lane. Back to work, he thought as he pushed himself up off the platform and climbed down the scaffold. He walked to the window where his hunting scope was already set up on its tripod and parted the curtains. There was a blur in the eyepiece as he tilted and panned and zoomed the scope over the city buildings and cell sites and water towers. When he was done, a sidewalk-level doorway was directly centered in the viewfinder. The door was a much-scuffed black steel one, outlined by blocks of pale-dressed granite set in a building wall of dull red brick. Lacking a handle or knob, it looked like the back egress door one might see at a theater. The British assassin smiled again as his mind made the obvious associations. Presidents and theaters and assassins, oh my, he thought.
Chapter 59. At 5 minutes after 4 o'clock, Mary Catherine put on the water for the ziti and then took out the mix for the cupcakes that Bridget and Fiona needed for their Clash Trip bake sale fundraiser. A Blake Shelton song came on the country western station as she was getting out the eggs, and she turned it up and began humming along as she stood at the island cracking the eggs into a mixing bowl. From the dining room, Eddie Bennett watched all this in his peripheral vision as he pretended to do his homework.
"How's it going in there, Eddie?"
Mary Catherine called out as she chucked the eggshells into the can behind her without looking.
"Never better," Eddie lied.
Eddie had been relegated to the dining room table under Mary Catherine's watchful eye until further notice because he'd come home with another C in math. Quite unfairly, in his opinion. To his thinking, a C was actually more than acceptable because, as everyone knew, math was idiotic and pointless. What the heck was algebra for, anyway? Would he one day find himself pinned in a car wreck, struggling for his life, and at the last second save himself by remembering that x equals 7 plus y times 5r? The answer to that one was no. Numbers and equations were inherently evil, as was his cruel and unusual imprisonment here at the table of pain. No doubt about it, instead of doing extra math problems, what he really needed at this juncture was the iPad that Mary Catherine had hidden on him. Or, more specifically, he needed what was on the tablet. The utterly amazing and cool Zombie Highway Squish, his new favorite video game. That's why when the whir of Mary Catherine's mixer started up a minute later, he made his move. Tiptoeing into the living room as stealthily as the ninja he one day hoped to become, he quickly searched all of Mary Catherine's favorite hiding spots for banned items. On top of the bookshelf, under the couch, behind Dad's chair. "What are you up to now, you little sneak?" Brian said around the yellow highlighter jutting from his mouth as he sat on the couch squinting at some paperback Shakespeare. "Aren't you supposed to be doing your homework?"
"Looking for my, workbook," Eddie said, innocently.
Now where would she hide it?
Eddie thought.
He snapped his fingers. Precisely. The last place it was allowed to be. In the boys' room.
He hurried into their darkened room and had just peeked in the closet when he saw the sheets hanging loose at the side of Marvin's bunk. Eddie went over immediately and lifted the mattress. And just stood there, staring and staring at the gun sitting there on the box spring. It was a subcompact, a small semi-auto black metal pistol with a light green cross-hatch synthetic rubber side panel on the grip. Eddie, who may have played very realistic first-person shooter video games at a friend's house, didn't have to read the P-32 Kel-Tec stamped into the scuffed black steel of the pistol's barrel to know that it was real. He even knew at a glance that it was loaded, by the little metal comma of the magazine sticking out at the bottom of the grip. What he didn't know was what it was doing there. Nor did he care.
His young brain was too mesmerized by the sight of the sleek, L-shaped hunk of dark metal that lay there, practically glowing with coolness. He suddenly longed to feel it in his hand, just once, just for a second.
"What the hell are you doing?" Brian said suddenly at his back.
Eddie, spasming as if he'd been tasered, dropped the mattress.
I'm sorry, I was looking for the iPad, I swear," he said, backing up with his hands raised.
Brian went to the bed and lifted the mattress and then removed the gun, mindful of the trigger. He stared at it with a furious look on his face.
"I can't believe this. He'd bring this here, into our room?"
Brian said in an outrage. He quickly left the room with the gun.
"Hey, where are you going, Brian? Dinner won't be long."
Eddie heard Mary Catherine call from the kitchen.
"To the library. Be back quick. Promise," Brian said.
"Oh, no,"
Eddie whispered to himself as he heard the apartment door slam shut with a loud bang.
"What did I do now?"
Chapter 60. "Hello, do you sell Barrett's?" I said into the phone. "The 50 caliber sniper rifle?" asked the dealer at Harry's Guns for the Good Guys of Dublin, Pennsylvania, the 17th gun dealer I had spoken to in the last hour. "Yes," I said. "Is this a joke?" he said. "No," I said. "You are aware that the rifle you're talking about costs in excess of $10,000, he said. "I also believe the going rate of each round is $4 or $5. "Yes, I heard it's expensive. Do you have one?" "Money's no object, huh? Lucky you," the guy on the phone said. "Well, no, I don't have the gun in stock per se, but what we can do is have you order it online and then purchase it through me. See, they won't just ship it to your house unless you have a federal firearms dealer's license. You have to have it shipped to my store so we can do the background paperwork and whatnot. Provided you don't live in New York, New Jersey, or Connecticut, which all have a ban on large-caliber sniper rifles." Too bad no one had told the guy who had almost blown away President Buckland from the MetLife building, I thought. "Wow, that's interesting," I said to the dealer. Then I asked him what I really wanted to know. "Have you actually bought any Barrett's for anyone recently?" "Don't I wish," he said with a sigh. "Dealers get a tidy cut of the Barrett's price for their trouble." A moment later, I racked the phone after another dead end and rubbed my eyes and stared up into the dusty ceiling of our task force's new workspace at the FBI's Midtown building at 56th Street. The first office had been drab, but this one was even more so. A small, windowless cell in one of the sub-basements. It had a striking resemblance to a boiler room. Was it because we were working with the CIA now that we had to be in some secure, bomb-proof location? I kept wondering. Would we be issued shoe phones? This new tack in our search for the shooter, talking to gun dealers, had come from our suspect-turned-partner CIA soldier, Matthew LaRue. He said if he was in town to take somebody out, he'd buy all his hardware locally if possible. It wouldn't be that difficult, he said, if you had the proper fake ID. That was just the thing with the task before us. We had to find a guy whose name we didn't know, a guy who was most likely moving around a lot, paying in cash, and using fake IDs, and find him discreetly, too. We were told by the Secret Service that in no way could we use the media in our manhunt. It would make Buckland look weak, as if dead look strong. No bones about it. Even with the spy agency's help, the case was still in bang-your-head-against-the-wall mode. We'd re-interviewed all the MetLife building people, did another forensic sweep through the blind in the MetLife building's roof. I'd even put out feelers to every former cop and detective I knew in Jersey and upstate New York and Long Island for anything. Any oddball incidents that might give us a lead, especially incidents involving people with British accents. After another minute of brooding, I sat back up straight and picked up my clipboard and dialed the number for the next gun dealer, a store called Benny's Gun Coliseum, located in an upstate town with the unlikely name of Butternuts, New York. "Yeah,
Hi. Do you sell Barrett's? I said.
Chapter 61.
Look, everyone, it's 5 o'clock, also known as vitamin C time, said Paul Erninwine as he came over with 2 red Solo cups of water and those little orange-flavored packets. I don't know if it was due to his FBI training, but Paul, I had learned, was very particular in his workday habits. Coffee precisely at 9 and then 11, lunch at 1, another coffee at 3, vitamin C packet time at 5, in a red Solo cup. We had been spending a lot of time together.
Paul, tell me, how does the CIA even know it's the Brit?
I said, flicking at the terribly vague photo stuck to the whiteboard beside our desks. And don't say you can tell me, but then you'd have to kill me, because at this point, I'd say okay, just to figure out anything at all about what's going on with this Puzzle Palace stuff.
I don't know, Mike, Paul said. We just have to trust them, remember?
Trust them, sure, I said, but they're leaving something out.
A lot of somethings, more likely, said Paul as he ripped open and then poured out his packet into his cup. But think about it. These spooks have been asked to do some real questionable stuff since 9/11. Stuff that might make a new administration go, egads, what's this, and start looking for goats to scape.
So they're covering their ass, I said. Paul nodded as he lifted his Solo cup.
They pretty much have to, he said, as my personal phone rang.
Hi, Mike, sorry to bother you, Mary Catherine said.
No bother, Mary Catherine, what is it?
It's Brian, Mike. He said he was heading to the library, but he didn't come back. I texted him and tried to find my friends him, but his phone is off or something.
Do any of the kids know where he is?
Eddie seems to know something. He seems nervous. I'll keep working on him. Do you think he could swing by? I'm actually getting a little nervous myself. Also, Marvin hasn't come home yet either.
Same old story, huh? I said, shaking my head. More mysteries, I thought. When it rained, it poured. On my way, I said.
Chapter 62. A cold wind blew in Brian Bennett's face as he sat on a stone wall in the now dark Riverside Park near the Soldiers and Sailors Monument. He was facing west and down through the leafless trees. He watched the streaming red lights on the West Side Highway. There were some blinking red lights out on the black plain of the Hudson itself, he noticed. Some big ship, a tanker or something, looming out there on all that water. Just chilling. Chilling was the word, he thought, tightening the drawstrings on his hoodie before thrusting his hands back into his coat pockets. He checked his phone again. Nothing. What was up with this joker, he thought. He had said to be there in 20 a whole hour ago. Brian sighed as he noticed he had 7% battery left.
Just great,
he mumbled as he glanced over his shoulder, up the empty stairs toward the monument. After finding the gun, he'd walked around in a panic, trying for the life of him to figure out what to do. He wanted to tell his dad, of course, but what would happen then? Would Dad have to arrest Marvin? All the while thinking that any second a cop would notice the suspicious look on his face and ask to search his backpack. Then as he was about to head into the Starbucks on Broadway to warm up, it dawned on him. How to end this whole crazy thing once and for all.
Hey!
Said a voice from behind him. Brian turned up to the dark figure standing at the top of the monument stairs. Then he swallowed as Big Flicka, Marvin's crazy drug-dealing tormentor, started slowly walking down. A week ago, Brian had secretly gotten the dealer's number from Marvin's phone to give to his dad in case Marvin didn't make it home. An hour before, he had called Big Flicka and told him that he had found Marvin's gun in the room just before his parents were about to rearrange the furniture. He said that he was panicked and didn't know what to do with it, said that he had called Marvin and couldn't get in contact with him, and could Flicka come get it. And here he was, Brian thought, as the huge drug dealer halted in front of him, practically as big as the monument above.
Be careful what you wish for.
Chapter 63.
So you got it? Flicka said, scanning the park.
Yep, here it is,
Brian said quickly, reaching into his bag.
Easy now, you watch that shit,
Flicka said, tilting his head as he reached into his own pocket.
It's okay, I unloaded it,
he said as he handed over the racked semi-auto and its magazine.
Tell me why you're giving this to me again,
Flicka said, immediately tucking the items into the pocket of his enormous goose-down jacket.
My nanny was about to clean the room. I didn't know what to do, so I thought I could give it to you since you and Marvin work together or whatever.
Flicka eyed him, his glance icier than the wind off the Hudson.
Marvin tell you that, he said. We working together?
No, I just figured.
How you got my number then?
Oh shit, Brian thought. He hadn't anticipated that question. What should he say?
I found it in one of Marvin's notebooks, he finally pulled out of thin air.
Oh, you a real nanny boy, huh? Couldn't just leave it in your book bag? You think it gonna bite you? Gonna explode?
Guns don't kill people, boy. How stupid can you be?
I didn't know what to do, man. I thought this would help you out. I'm sorry to bother you. I was just trying to help, honestly.
Yeah, you better be sorry. And Marvin's gonna be real sorry, I guarantee you, after I get through teaching him about how to properly stash my precious belongings.
Big Flicka suddenly leaned in close to where Brian sat on the wall. Brian held his breath. He was one big, big dude.
Now you listen up, because I'm only going to tell you once, you nosy little nanny boy,
Flicka said in his ear.
Don't you be concerning yourself anymore about me and Marvin. Do I need to illustrate how bad that would turn out for you, for your family?
No, I got it, honestly, Brian said.
Please, I'm sorry.
Flicka tisked as he slowly backed off. Then he laughed and smiled. Like intimidating people was the funniest joke in the world. He actually